6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our radio quality and other means.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. And here is a quick look at what's coming up next, so be sure not to miss a moment. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Afterwards, we return with another segment of radio production. Up next, spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The Hezbollah leader Sheikh Naim Qassem has said the Lebanese resistance movement will not surrender or lay down its weapons in response to Israeli threats despite mounting pressure to disarm. The Lebanese authorities, under pressure from the Zionist regime and Western governments, most notably the U.S. and France, have called on the resistance group to disarm and lay down its arms. Now, this, as many today attribute the integrity of Lebanon's sovereignty to Hezbollah's arms, its determination and protection of Lebanese soil. It was Hezbollah that put an end to Israel's occupation of Lebanon and kept the country whole for the past few decades. And Sheikh Qassem says, quote, "We will continue to defend because we believe liberation is our duty." This and more of the Sheikh's statements and positions outlined during his speech and interview is what we'll cover in today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us, Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief at MENA Uncensored from Lebanese capital, Beirut. And also, Mr. Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator, also joining us from the Lebanese capital. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we will do the gentlemanly thing and start with you, Ms. Leila Hatoum. Hezbollah argues that Lebanese politicians have opted, Leila, for silence towards repeated aggression by the Zionist regime on Lebanese territory since the infamous late November 27th ceasefire's implementation, including assassinations and occupation. Your initial take on options that Beirut has to defend itself?
Well, you have to understand one thing. When it comes to Lebanon, we have nothing to lose at the moment. And as resistance, basically, so long that you have an occupation, the resistance doesn't have to listen to the dictations of neither the Lebanese government nor the international community. International law gives it the right to move freely in terms of fighting that occupation. At the end of the day, there is mounting pressure on Lebanon, not only by the Americans and the Israelis and basically their allies across the world. I call them the axis of evil. But also from internally, the internal front in Lebanon is divided, severely polarized when it comes to politics and politicians. Some of them, they support the West, and they are funded by the West and the GCC countries, among other Arab nations who are anti-Hezbollah, and somehow like they have animosity against Iran. So at the end of the day, all this basically surmounting pressure that we call tells Hezbollah that they have no allies around in terms of this particular region, and they have to fend for themselves. And that's why basically we saw Sheikh Naim Qassem actually commenting on that matter, saying that so long that there's an aggression, we will not back off from resisting. Nobody can force us to do so, and we will continue to fight, but according to our own time, and we will respond in the manner that we see fit.
Thank you there, Leila. Mr. Mohsen Saleh, welcome to the program. Sir, now, Mr. Saleh, I'm going to put the same question to Sheikh Qassem. In response to nearly 4,000 ceasefire violations by the occupation since late November, and the occupation also of five strategic hilltops there in southern Lebanon, said what Israel is not is committed to is implementing the first stage of the agreement, that is withdrawing, stopping its aggression and reconnaissance flights, releasing the prisoners, and starting reconstruction. He said, as much as we are concerned, the equation that America and Israel want to impose, namely either kill or surrender, is not acceptable. What is important to us is our rights. We are ready to be martyred or to win, and we are ready for both choices. Now, Mr. Mohsen Saleh, many people feel this should be the exact position of the Aoun government as well.
Well, good evening to you and to your guests and to the crew and to the audiences. I guess it's about time, as Sheikh Naim, the Secretary General, said, it's about time for people to understand that the resistance attitude from this paper of Brack, Thomas Brack, and the Republic or the Lebanese Republic or the presidents, the three presidents, the Prime Minister and the Speaker and also the President Aoun, I guess they have some kind of asking the same questions of Hezbollah and the resistance. First of all, the Israelis have not been committed to the resolution 1701. They continued their war against the Lebanese territories and the Lebanese people in the south, on the borders and otherwise, in reaching to Tripoli, killing people, assassinating people, preventing the Lebanese government from spreading or putting its authority in the south. So I guess we are close to the kind of national unity about the issue of the arms. While the Americans and the Westerns, they are threatening the Lebanese government and the people, the Lebanese people, and of course Hezbollah, they are threatening them of the Israeli attack on Lebanon, initiating another war. That's the point, I guess. Now Hezbollah is ready for all the possibilities in terms of confronting and combating on the ground whenever the Israelis want to initiate a war, to also go into the deep borders of Lebanon and also reaching to Syria. That's what they are threatening. I guess it's about time for the international community and the people of the Lebanese government as well to understand that the resistance was not defeated during the talks to arrange the ceasefire. The Israelis were defeated on the ground, in the battlefield. They have shouted and yelled and talked to the Americans, asked them urgently to stop the fire and issue a momentum to stop the fire in the south. That's why the Lebanese government is really trying to understand the resistance position from this situation, while the Americans are always putting the ground for facilitating the way for the Israelis in order to be to have the hegemony in the south and in Lebanon, preparing for the new Middle East, as Netanyahu said, and preparing also for naturalization with Lebanon. This will not happen. The resistance is still ready and more powerful than the past, and the coming days will show that the resistance having all the power that will retaliate against the aggressions of the Israelis. You have mentioned 4,000 attack or violation against the 1701. I would ask the Israelis always, every day they have violation, every day, not only once, all their drones in the skies of Lebanon or their warplanes in Lebanon and on the borders, they attack even the people who are going back in order to check their homes and their farms, but they are preventing everything. But it's about time to tell the Israelis to stop and the Americans to stop the pressure on the Lebanese, because the Lebanese will not will not be lenient towards these attacks and these violations.
And good points there, Mr. Assad. Thank you. And Leila, your thoughts on why certain powers are demanding Hezbollah disarm. We have to ask, Leila, why? What is Hezbollah doing or has it done to warrant laying down its arms? Because one thing Israel has over the years, over the decades, proven is that it is a direct threat to Lebanon, its sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Well, if you look at the whole situation from the Israeli aggression on Lebanon and the second invasion in 1980, because they invaded 1978 first, the presence of multiple resistance groups on the ground were kind of effective in harming a little bit the Israelis, but they were never successful in pushing the Israelis out of most of South Lebanon. The only resistance that managed to actually kick out the Israelis from most of South Lebanon and using strategic weapons and strategic training and their bases and their basically what you call social milieu is growing year on year, time after time, is Hezbollah. So Hezbollah forms what you call danger to the Israeli plan of having greater Israel, of expanding into South Lebanon and most of Lebanon, if not all of Lebanon, later on to greater Israel, as well as it actually invokes hope in people that there is a possibility if you stand in the face of an aggressor, you can actually beat that aggressor. So at the end of the day, the Israelis are trying to eliminate this glitch in the system. The only way they can do so, they know that they cannot eradicate Hezbollah or the resistance in Lebanon because resistance is an idea. At the end of the day, what they're trying to do is weaken Hezbollah to the extent that they are going to try to disarm it from its strategic weapons and create a toothless tiger out of it. And this is impossible to happen, knowing the Lebanese and knowing their mentality and knowing how they basically stick to their land and they fight back. They are some of the strongest fighters in the region. So because they pose threat to the Israeli entity and its plan for the region to have greater Israel and the European and Western plan in general to continue to have this parasitic entity among us and subdue and subjugate the rest of the populations in our region, that's the reason why they're going after Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. And Mr. Saleh, also elsewhere in Sheikh Qasem's remarks, he roundly rejected for the movement to lay down its arms. He said there is no third option between victory and martyrdom. We do not have surrender as an option. So Hezbollah's position, it is and it has been simple, cut and dry. How do you see things playing out? Hezbollah maintains this position. Moving forward, the pressure persists from the U.S. and its allies and the Zionist entity. Where does it end, or do we reach an impasse, or how do you see this thing unfolding in the future?
Well, in the manner of the Israeli natural instinct towards Lebanon and towards the Palestinians and towards all the Arabs and even the human beings, in confronting such instincts, I guess the resistance in Lebanon, they have no choice, no option but to continue in struggling against these criminals who committed all the crimes in the modern history in Gaza and in Lebanon and anywhere in the places wherever they go, to Yemen, to Iran, of course. What would you do but to tackle and grip your hand on the arms you have and the courage you have and the belief of not only victory, but you have to defend by blood and by the arms. It's these real things. As I said in the beginning, that the resistance was not defeated on the ground. They have implanted their bodies and their blood in on the borders and prevented the Israelis from going into the Lebanese villages and cities in Khiyam and Naqoura and Ayd al-Shaab and other places. So I would say Sheikh Naim, the Secretary General, is reaching the point that the resistance, the freedom fighters in the South, they are saying that they are ready to continue the battle against this enemy who will not stop but by the resistance. The resistance, the only way, the only path in order to stop this enemy from putting an end to its aggression. And the Americans and the Lebanese government, they understand that. That's why Barak said he won't guarantee any Israeli aggression. He knows, and the Europeans know that they cannot stop the Israelis. The only thing that might stop the Israelis is the resistance. That's why Sheikh Naim said, either martyrdom or victory. There is no other choice. As you said, brother, is there any other choice, any other option in confronting the Israelis? The problem is that either they have the hegemony and the upper hand and to enslave others, or to kill them. That's what they have been doing in Gaza and the West Bank. That's what they want to do in Lebanon. But the issue is that the resistance in Lebanon is powerful, strong, and believe in its right in defending its place. The might does not make right. The Israelis have no right in order to invade or to kill or to occupy any parts of Lebanon. That's why the Lebanese government has only one choice, but to come to unity with the resistance in order to protect the sovereignty and the authority. If the government insists on having the monopoly over everything in Lebanon, under the pressure of the American and the French and the Europeans, I guess we are going to a deadlock and not having a solution. That's what the Israelis want. But I would say firmly, with great confidence, that the Israelis cannot go into Lebanon and invade Lebanon, because the resistance is still powerful and have all the integrity and the honor and the decision to fight against the Israelis. And they have tried the resistance in Lebanon, and they could not achieve anything but by the resolution. And the resistance gave some time for the government in order to continue its diplomatic power or relations with the Americans and others. But I would say, with no pessimism, that the resistance has the right, and I am very optimistic that the resistance can achieve what they want, the freedom fighters, the strugglers for freedom in the South, Lebanon, exactly in South Lebanon. They can achieve something I guess nobody has achieved, because they achieved, as okay, your guest said, they achieved victory in 2000, where all the Arab governments, they could not achieve anything.
And that's a very good point. I was going to bring that up later as well. Thank you, Mr. Saleh. And Leila, and I'm glad Mr. Saleh made this point, that it seems all the justification points to the pressure being on Tel Aviv and not on Beirut. Because we have to really ask ourselves, we have to highlight, actually, every time that Hezbollah carried out an operation against the occupation, what was it about? It was either to defend against occupation of Lebanon, to defend against some kind of aggression, or in the latest case, to defend against genocide, the wholesale slaughter by the Zionist entity against the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza. It's always been a retaliatory resistance type operation to either defend something, protect something, or push something off of land it does not belong on. all the justification is for Hezbollah to remain intact and for the condemnation to be toward Tel Aviv and not vice versa.
Well, you have to understand that when you are called a resistance, you are a reaction to an original action, that's an occupation. So everything that the resistance does, even if it's attacking the occupation anywhere across the world, by the way, according to international law, it has to attack it. It has the right to attack it across the world. It's a retaliation to the original sin, which is the occupation. So having said that, they are covered no matter what. Unfortunately, people look at it from a classical perspective, trying to find justifications to the resistance and trying to basically claim that the pressure is now on Tel Aviv to stop this war, etc. No, this is not the case. When you look at the whole situation, unfortunately, in reality, we live in the real world. Most of the nations across us from this region and beyond are siding with the Israeli entity and trying to pressure resistance movements and those who are supporting the resistance movements to back off and allow the Israeli occupation to have a breather. In that sense, the pressure is on Tel Aviv in terms of the possible danger posed against it by resistance movements in this region, especially from Hezbollah and Lebanon and Amal movement, among other basic resistance movements, but also, not only basically from those resistance movements, but also from those supporting them. And in that sense, Tel Aviv is pressuring its allies to go and pressure Lebanon, the Lebanese government, to create a problem for Hezbollah internally and the resistance in Lebanon internally by saying that we have to discuss the matter of your weapons, you have to disarm, and we see politicians within the government and beyond trying to create that pressure. Having said that, you also have to understand another thing. No matter how much they try, under international law, a government has no right, any government, including the local government, has no right to disarm the resistance so long that there's an occupation. And I'll give an example. The Vichy government in France, which used to cooperate with the Nazi occupation of France, used to call the French resistance terrorists. So that's why the international law came about, to support the French resistance. The way I look at it, the resistance in Lebanon at the moment is living what we call a golden chance of actually doing what it needs and what it wants to do without having to look back, because one, everybody around it has taken off their masks, two, international law is on its side, and three, at the same time, they have taken enough time to reassess what happened and to rebuild. And this is what Sheikh Naim Qassem, Hezbollah Secretary General, said in his most recent interview and his past speeches, and to plan what's going to go ahead. When it comes to Tel Aviv, they're afraid because they don't know the new leadership in Hezbollah and the first-tier leadership in terms of battlefields and the ground, commanders. They don't know who they are. They don't know how they think. They don't know how they act. Hezbollah turned back to the situation of the 1980s when you had an Israeli occupation. Syria was against Lebanon at the time, against the resistance. You had a massive disruption in terms of political powers. They were all polarized, some against the resistance, some pro-resistance. So we're back to that situation. The only difference is that the Israelis have been blocked out of spying on Hezbollah in terms of technology, because Hezbollah went back to that, what you call, plan of 1980s. Now we see the real deal. The Israelis are going to attack, or they continue to actually breach the resistance's social milieu by killing people every day in South Lebanon. You're going to see a reaction later on. But the resistance doesn't act hormonally. It doesn't act emotionally. They act smartly, so that's why they're patient.
And we don't have much time left, but I really want to get this last question to Mr. Saleh. Mr. Saleh, can you imagine, for years, U.S., its European allies in Israel, they've wanted to disarm many of the resistance groups in the region. They wanted to basically anyone that is hostile against the Israeli apartheid occupation entity, Hezbollah. They want Hezbollah's arms. They want Hamas's arms. They want Islamic Jihad's arms. They want to disarm the Ansarullah. They want Iran's missiles, you very well know, for years now. Tell me, if they were successful in putting an end to all the resistance in the region, what would West Asia look like at that point, and how would anyone counter Israel's expansionism?
Well, I would say if that happened, and God forbids this from happening, I guess the gloomy environment would surround the whole countries and the peoples of the region. But I would say no. They have tried to disarm Hezbollah in 1991, in 1993, in 1996, in 2006, and after that also they have tried a lot. and the Americans were backing the Israelis, and they have initiated many wars, and they failed. And this, at the same time, they failed in 2024 in order to disarm and invade Lebanon. They have failed in their planning and designing the way to disarm Lebanon, disarm the mentality and the intellect of Lebanon of having this guts in order to continue their combating the Israelis and to confronting the Israelis. Now, I guess Lebanon, after the martyrdom of the master of the martyrs of the community of the Ummah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, well, once he said, well, the Israelis are fighting people who loves Imam Hussein and loves now Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Imam Khomeini and the people of having this this spirit of resistance and the spirit of having this freedom in order to continue their march for a new liberty for the region. I would not expect any kind of this kind of defeat. You have mentioned my brother. I won't see any picture like having the Israelis. They have their problems. They have their social and military and problems even in Gaza, in spite of all these massacres all over Gaza. But they have not defeated the Gazans from resisting this this occupation every day in Beit Hanun, in Khan Yunus, anywhere you will find operation that would brightly done by the these strugglers in Gaza. And I guess the Lebanese resistance is as well as powerful and as well as having the decision and having the spirit of continuing the resistance. I am very optimistic about this. They have planned. They have conspired with all the Americans and the Westerns and some of the Arabs. They pressure the resistance. But I will the returning of the spirit of the resistance in this region from Yemen to Palestine and Lebanon, even in some parts of Syria, even in Iraq, in the West Bank, all these people, they cannot put them down at all.
Thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Stay to the both of you, Leila Hatoum and also Mr. Mohsen Saleh, both joining us from Beirut. And viewers, this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
In Iran's proud and glorious history, brave and selfless commanders shine like radiant stars in the sky. Men who, through courage, faith, and knowledge, have always stood as pillars of this land's security and strength. Major General Hossein Salami, the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran, was one of the most prominent and influential figures in the history of Iran's sacred defense and the national security. With decades of military experience, a strategic vision, and an approach rooted in authority and innovation, he played a key role in safeguarding the country's security and progress. In the early hours of June 13, 2025, he attained the great honor of martyrdom in a cowardly attack by the Zionist regime on Iranian soil. General Salami was martyred in this treacherous attack, a man who, with his commitment, knowledge, and courage, became a symbol of resistance and steadfastness for the Iranian nation. Hossein Salami completed his primary and secondary education in the city of Gulpaygan, central Iran, and after taking the National University entrance exam, was admitted to Tehran University of Science and Industry in 1978 to study mechanical engineering. His presence in Tehran and at the university coincided with the peak of the Islamic Revolution against the Pahlavi regime, and he joined the ranks of revolutionary student activists. After the revolutionary victory, he briefly worked in popular committees, but with the outbreak of imposed war by Iraq's Ba'ath regime against Iran in September 1980, he joined the defense of the homeland, becoming a member of the IRGC. After the eight-year Iran-Iraq War, Commander Salami pursued professional and academic advancement, enrolling in the Officers' University. Commander Salami was one of the founders of the University of the Command and Staff in the IRGC and served as its commander from its establishment in 1992 until 1995. From 1995 to 2005, he served as a deputy chief of operations of the IRGC Joint Staff, after which he was appointed as the commander of IRGC Aerospace Force, a critical role during which Iran's missile and aerospace capabilities saw significant advancements. Major General Salami possessed multidimensional qualities and exceptional leadership capabilities. He was a distinguished scholar, an alumnus of the prestigious University of Science and Industry in Engineering, and a faculty member at the National Defense University in the Strategic Studies, giving him a high level of academic expertise. He was a memorizer of the Quran and Nahjul Balagha, but more than that, he embodied their teachings. Those who interacted with him closely could attest that this leadership was Quranic and his decisions were often visibly inspired by Quranic logic. As a commander, while he was firm and authoritative, he also maintained a deep emotional and heartfelt connection with all ranks and subordinates. Undoubtedly, Major General Salami was one of the most outstanding commanders of the Islamic Revolution, a man of jihad in scientific, cultural, security, and military fields who stood at the forefront of defending the revolution's ideals with sincerity, wisdom, and loyalty. His patience and ethical leadership made him a commander who inspired calm and confidence in those around him. His unmatched bravery, inherited from the days of jihad and epic resistance, made him a formidable leader who struck fear into the hearts of enemies. Though the martyrdom of this noble commander and his comrades inflicted deep sorrow on the Iranian nation and armed forces, their pure blood has undoubtedly strengthened the towering tree of the Islamic Revolution. It has further solidified the resolve of the great Iranian nation and its revolutionary children to confront global Zionism and its wicked criminal supporters. Just hours after the criminal and terrorist aggression, in the early morning of Friday, June 13th, Iran delivered a decisive and powerful response by launching Operation True Promise 3, dealing a historic and devastating blow to the Zionist enemy. This marks only the beginning of the path of national vengeance, and the Zionist regime must know that the era of unanswered crimes has come to an end. As Iranian renowned scholar Martyr Murtaza Mutahhari once said in describing martyrs, The martyr's role is not merely to stand against the enemy, to strike or to be struck. If that were all, we would have to say that when he is struck and his blood is spilled, it is wasted. No, the blood of a martyr is never wasted. It does not fall to the ground. Every drop of a martyr's blood transforms into hundreds, thousands of drops, even an ocean of blood, flowing into the veins of society. Thus the Prophet, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, said, "No drop is more virtuous in the sight of Allah than a drop of blood spilled in his way." Martyrdom is the injection of blood into the body of society. It is the martyrs who infuse new blood into the veins of society.
You mean everything, hear you talking when you're sleeping. Reality, know you're going through hardship, and I know that you're scared, but you don't need to worry, cause Allah is there. Ooh, oh, I will never let you go. You're my heart, my life, my soul, and the choices that we make, we gotta make our own. Gonna stand on our feet. Take this direction. When we take on the world, all the diamonds and pearls couldn't take me away from your smile and your love. And I know you feel lost and you wanna give up. After every hardship comes ease, hardship comes ease. May Allah bless our way and our intention. Stay pure. Hardship comes in.
Greetings, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here's a preview of what's coming up next on your trusted radio station. Up first, take a moment for thoughtful reflection with Hadith of the Day. Next, we turn to Islamic laws with Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of the prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Following that, join us for Africa Today. For those seeking to deepen their connection with the Holy Quran, don't miss Let's Recite the Quran. Coming up next, it's the Hadith of the Day. Stay tuned.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more. No
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danesh, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brother, dear sister, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Have you ever wondered why some people spend their whole lives hoarding wealth only to die stressed and empty, while others, with far less, seem peaceful and fulfilled? Why are we sometimes proud despite being made from something as humble as a drop of fluid? Today we explore one of the most powerful reflections in human history, a quote from Imam Ali alayhi salam, a man whose wisdom shaped generations. He once said, "I am amazed at the miser who rushes towards poverty he tries to avoid." Who rushes toward poverty he tries to avoid. And it only gets deeper. Let's break it down first. He says, "The miser hurries toward poverty which he tries to flee, and loses the wealth he seeks." Modern psychology backs this up. A study by the University of Minnesota found that people obsessed with saving often increase their anxiety, leading to poor health and even early mortality. They live poor, stressed lives, yet leave behind unused riches. It's ironic. They suffer like the poor, but will be held accountable like the rich. Practical advice: spend wisely, save reasonably, but live meaningfully. Generosity reduces stress and increases happiness. Science confirms this again and again. Next, he says, "I'm amazed at the arrogant one who was a drop of fluid yesterday and will be a corpse tomorrow." This is biology's truth. We start as a microscopic sperm and egg. Then our bodies decompose like any other organic matter. Yet some of us walk with inflated egos. Why? Neuroscientists have shown that humility, not pride, correlates with emotional intelligence, and long-term success. Pride isolates, humility connects. So what my advice? Remember your origin and end. It keeps your heart soft and your mind open. And Imam alayhi salam continues, I'm amazed at the one who doubts God while seeing his creation. From the human eye's complexity to the vast order of galaxies, even atheist scientists like Fred Hoyle admitted that the universe looks like a put-up job. The signature of intelligence is everywhere, in DNA, in ecosystems, in consciousness itself. Tip: next time you're in nature, pause, ask, who designed this system I'm part of? So inshallah, we'll reflect on these and inshallah try to be realistic to see the facts and truths. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here? So unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, who is in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have started discussing some of the jurisprudential laws related to Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, and would like to continue along the same line. Let me ask you this at the beginning of this episode, Sheikh Javid. During the month of the Muharram, commemorative processions and the sounds of drums and trumpets continue until after midnight.
Right.
What's the view on such a practice?
Well, while commemorating Imam Hussein is meritorious, it is an act of virtue. Islamic ethics stress not causing harm to the neighbors. Islamic ethics emphasize on not causing annoyance to others, such as, you know, the immediate neighbors trying to sleep.
Yes.
The noise, especially if excessive or prolonged late into the night, may turn a good deed into a sinful act.
Yes.
Yes. Participating in majalis of Imam Hussein in morning gatherings is okay, it's recommended, it's permissible, but such practices must not be a source or a cause of annoyance and disturbance for other people who might want to go to job, who might be sick, who might be have a lot of problems. So it's very important to observe moderation and to be mindful in such cases. And then we should follow the teachings of Ahlul Bayt and the teachings of the Prophet in not harming other people, see, and not causing nuisance for other people in such cases.
I see. Well, is it permissible, Chestovit, for women to take part in the processions where beating the chest and lashing with chains take place, provided that they observe hijab and wear special clothes?
Well, this is one of the most frequently asked questions. Even if women observe proper hijab and wear mourning clothing, their participation in physical expressions of grief in public procession is not considered appropriate, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. And these rituals are emotionally intense and often attract public attention, you know. Islam promotes maintaining a woman's dignity and modesty in public, and, you know, it's important that women should stay away from those places where men practice chest beating and beating their back with chains, because they usually take off their shirt, and so a woman's presence might distract not only their attention but also the attention of those who want to engage in mourning and practice, you know, the chest beating and also doing azadari. So I would say that the women should be careful not to attend such places.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shachavid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Shachavid, what's the jurisprudential law concerning the people who fall on the floor before they enter the holy shrines of the imams, peace be upon them all? You know, they creep on the floor and they rubbing their face and chest on the grounds, bruising their body, and sometimes, not to mention, leads to bleeding.
Well, I think such acts do not make sense. You know, acts like throwing oneself to the ground or causing bodily injury in an attempt to display grief, such acts do not make sense. Not even for Shia Muslims, let alone those people who are not, who do not believe in the Shia Islam or in the fundamentals of the Shia faith.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that such practices are not part of the authentic Islamic tradition, and they have no basis in Islamic Sharia as well. So if they cause harm or humiliation or tarnish the public perception of Shiism, they are prohibited. It's important that we must be very careful not to damage the image of the Shia Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So the imams themselves actually emphasized reasoned, spiritual, and constructive mourning, not extremism, not harming, and not doing anything which is likely to be misunderstood.
I see.
Not to mention of when it is definitely misunderstood.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, what is the ruling of beating the drum and cymbal, blowing the trumpet in the commemorative gatherings or during the processions of the commemoration of the Imam Hussein?
There is no problem in such things, you know. It is okay, it is permissible, and of course the religious authorities have not criticized such things. You know, as long as they are considered acts of azadari according to the people of the very community where it is practiced. Like, for example, we see in different cultures that the way people mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein is different from consider the people living in Kashmir. There's a large Shia community in the Indian administered Kashmir, and also people living in Pakistan. Those people living in Uttar Pradesh or Bangladesh. So different people and different Shia communities across the world have their own way of mourning and the martyrdom of Muslims. Okay and no problem.
I see. What is the ruling in the matter of lashing oneself with chains as done by some Muslims?
It depends, you know. When we use the term chains, the Indian Muslims and the Pakistani Shia Muslims understand it in one way because you're using the term chain. And when we use zanjir, okay, zanjir is a term which is also understood by Indian Shia Muslims and Pakistani Shia Muslims as chains with swords, with knives.
Yes.
Knives are attached to the chain.
Yes.
So when you say, okay, it's permissible, they will come to see and understand it in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to note that when we use the term chain, you mean chain only, not knives, not swords, not any cutting tools. So when it comes to chains, of course, it's okay. There's no problem. Shia Muslims all over the world have been beating their chests throughout history, and it's a way of mourning. It's a form of mourning, provided that it's solemn, it is considered with modesty, and there's no, bloodletting, based on the fatwa of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, any act which leads to some kind of bloodletting is forbidden, because it is forbidden, first of all, because it is prohibited in Islam to cause harm to oneself, and it's forbidden because it destroys the image of the Shia Islam and the religious integrity. It is prohibited because it undermines the message of Karbala. What was Karbala for? Why did Imam Hussein actually rise up against the Yazid of his time? What was the message of his uprising? So the whole message is undermined. And not only that, the gravest harm is the tarnishing of the image of the school of Ahlul Bayt. The school of Ahlul Bayt is a peace-loving school. It's not violent. And I do believe that all Islamic denominations and even the other denominations outside Islam believe that the Shia Islam is a religion of reason, akhl.
Yes.
And reason does not allow any of these acts of bloodletting.
I see.
So it's not permissible to practice tatbir or qamazani or whatever they call the Indian Shia Muslims, they call it talwarzani. So that's not permissible.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Allahumma arzuqni, Allahumma arzuqni shafa'atan Husayn.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to Muharram based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javed, what's the ruling in the matter of buying and selling on the 9th and 10th of Muharram, Tasu'a and Ashura? Is there any problem?
Well, in and of itself, it is not haram to buy and sell things because people need grocery, and some people actually keep their shops open, their markets open, in order to help the mu'mineen buy things. And then these many people buy biscuits, and cakes or let's say juice,
yes,
and distribute as an act of charity in Faqh,
yes,
among the mourners. So if the shops are closed and remain closed during the 9th and the 10th day,
yes,
so they will not be allowed. So they will not be able to